When I was 19, I got pregnant. I was a good person, a smart person. I would have been a good mother. I loved my baby. So I went to an adoption agency that specialized in young unwed mothers, and the experience truly scarred me. They talked to me like I was a vessel and not a person. It became clear to me that whoever adopted my baby would be trading their financial privilege for my child. Why couldn't I have that money to raise my own baby and save everyone the trauma? I couldn't face it, so I had an abortion. I had an abortion because I loved my baby and could not give them to people I didn't know and could not raise them myself. In a different world, I would have chosen differently. We don't have a different world, and the people who claim to oppose abortion are working overtime to ensure we never have a different world. Hi, I'm Zahn Valliens, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, we are going to talk about bad ideas about adoption, coercive adoption, and adoption trauma with my amazing guest, TJ Raphael, the reporter of the Liberty Lost podcast. TJ is an award-winning investigative journalist focusing on the intersection of reproductive health, politics, and science. In June 2025, she released the multi-episode audio documentary Liberty Lost with Wondery, one of the world's leading podcast production companies. The series dives deep into a modern-day maternity home where motherhood is treated as a privilege, not a right. The show paints a vivid picture that exposes the coercion and manipulation birth mothers often experience across the adoption industry. Following its release, Liberty Lost quickly climbed Apple's coveted Top 200 podcast chart, topping out as the number two series in America and reaching number one in their society and culture section. The show was praised by critics across the globe for its raw vulnerability and startling revelations, and won gold at the 2025 Signal Awards for Best Documentary. For her work on Liberty Lost, TJ won a front page award from the Newswomen's Club of New York for investigative reporting, and she is currently nominated by the Podcast Academy for an Ambie Award for Best Reporting. Before her time with Wondery, TJ was an on-air host, reporter, and senior producer for Sony's global podcast division. Two of her most notable podcasts with Sony include Cover Up, The Pill Plot, about the American abortion wars, and Biohacked, Family Secrets, about the shadowy business of sperm and egg donation. Prior to Sony, TJ was part of the leadership team overseeing Slate Magazine's podcast network, which garnered 180 million downloads a year. She began her career in audio journalism in 2013 when she took on a multifaceted role at WNYC, the largest public radio station in America. TJ began her career in print journalism with reporting and editorial roles at The Village Voice, The New York Daily News, and The Legislative Gazette, grounding her audio work in traditional investigative and accountability reporting. TJ is mixed race, Puerto Rican and Irish, and was born and raised in the New York City metro area. She is the first in her family to graduate from college. Today, TJ lives in the World's Borough, Queens. When she's not making podcasts, she likes to take trips to ride the Coney Island Cyclone and spend time with her husband, Christopher, her border collie, Smokey, and her Great Pyrenees, Cooper. TJ, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
That's so much. And obviously, we're going to be talking primarily about Liberty Lost, but I'm probably going to want to talk to you a little bit about your other podcasts too. So we'll just cover what we can cover.
Absolutely.
Before we get started, I'm going to give my usual administrative reminders. This podcast depends on reader support, which you can offer in the form of heart reacts, positive reviews, and shares on social media. Comments and other engagement also really help boost the podcast visibility. And if you're a super fan, you can become a paid subscriber on Substack or on Patreon. Paid subscribers get at least 8 extra essays a month, plus a bonus podcast episode. They also get access to the private Liberating Motherhood support community. To sign up, visit zahn.substack.com or liberatingmotherhood.org. So, TJ, this is just such an amazing podcast. I told you before we started recording that I knew about it for a while before I listened to it, but I kept avoiding it because I knew it was just going to infuriate me. But what I was struck by is that you were able to tell these really sad stories in a way that inspired hope and that helped us see the humanity of everyone involved, even some of the sort of bad guys. So can you just tell me a little bit about Liberty Lost, how you came to do this, and what you learned from it?
Yeah, Liberty Lost is an investigation really into the private adoption industry and maternity homes across the United States. We primarily tell that bigger story through looking at one specific maternity home. It's called the Liberty Godparent Home, and it sits on the campus of Liberty University, which is America's, most powerful evangelical college in the United States, and one of our most powerful Christian institutions. Almost every American president since Ronald Reagan has visited Liberty University. Its alumni have argued cases before the su Supreme Court, have gotten jobs in the White House, have been elected to Congress. And, Charlie Kirk is an alumni of Liberty University. So Liberty University is an incredibly powerful institution. And yeah, I had never heard of this maternity home until I got a tip from a woman named Abby Johnson, who would wind up becoming my primary source for this series. When Abby reached out to me, it was in the summer of 2022. She was 31 years old at the time. I'm 2 years older than her, so we were close in age. And she told me that she had been sent to this maternity home on the campus of Liberty University in 2008, and that there she faced pressure, shame, coercion, and religious manipulation until she surrendered her baby for adoption to an affluent Christian couple. That alone was, shocking to hear, but also knowing that it had ties to Liberty, to Jerry Falwell, the founder of the university and the founder of the Moral Majority, alarms bells started going off for me pretty immediately. And so that's kind of where I began my reporting. And I realized along the way, it took about 2 years for us to make this series and release it, that Liberty Godparent Home and its associated adoption agency, Family Life Services, were not unique. They're actually symptoms of a much bigger problem that we have in the United States as it relates to vulnerable pregnant women, adoption, and Christian maternity homes. And so that's really how this story came about. I connected with Abby in the summer of 22. I began really reporting on this story in earnest the following year in 2023. I think my first interview date with Abby is August 1st, 2023. And yeah, the series was released in June 2025 to coincide with the anniversary of the overturning of Roe versus Wade.
So I'll tell you, it kept your series kept popping up in like my podcast feed, and I had dozens of people tell me that I needed to listen, and a bunch more say, "Well, you need to bring her on the podcast." And like I said, like I resisted and I resisted because I knew it was just going to like send me into a state of rage. But what I initially thought is that I thought that your podcast was about the maternity homes of the past. I did not realize that this was still such an ongoing problem and that this kind of coercion is happening now. So that to me was just like stunning. And it's appalling that this is happening. It's appalling that so few of us, including in the reproductive justice movement, even know about it. Can you talk a little bit about, I think some people hear of these places and they're like, oh, it's nice. They're pregnant and they don't want to be. And so they get taken care of and then they give their babies to loving families. Can you explain why that's not really what's happening and what is happening?
Yeah, I think in theory, maternity homes would be a good thing, because who goes to a maternity home? Kind of like you were just alluding to, it's a vulnerable pregnant woman or a pregnant person. Maybe they don't have support in their lives. They don't have access to a safe or stable partner. And they're pregnant at the same time. So it's sort of this perfect storm of circumstance, and that might lead someone to seek out a maternity home. The problem is, most of these maternity homes, my research found that a huge number of these facilities are affiliated with a group called Heartbeat International. And Heartbeat International is one of the world's largest anti-abortion organizations. They have a presence on every inhabited continent. And what happens within these maternity homes that are affiliated with Heartbeat or affiliated with other anti-abortion organizations or evangelical institutions is the women inside these facilities often get the message that it would be better for them to place their children for adoption, that their babies deserve a two-parent household, a heterosexual household at that. And it's, not right to be a single mother. It's not right that they may end up needing government assistance. And that the best thing that this, pregnant person can do is to permanently separate from their child. And so a lot of that is rooted in, evangelical doctrine. I'm not saying that this is something all evangelicals believe, but unfortunately, there is a big section of the community that, views single motherhood through a lens of shame and stigma and believes that, a child should not stay with a single mother. And so the women inside these facilities, yeah, especially when they're living there, they're hearing day in and day out throughout their pregnancy, it's better to separate from the child. And oftentimes they don't have that external support. That's why they're in a maternity home. And so, I would love to see, secular or progressive institutions open up maternity homes because I do think there is a need for vulnerable pregnant women and other pregnant people to be able to find safe harbor while they're pregnant and be able to get on their feet. But as it stands right now, most of these institutions come with an agenda, and that is, a very conservative, Christ-centered agenda that espouses certain beliefs.
Yeah, the shame and the stigma is really prominent, and I think it's easy to kind of be dismissive of it if you have not grown up in that kind of culture or not familiar with how it functions. But to me, as a listener, kind of like looking in from the outside, I was struck by how this maternity home wasn't just like a place to land where you were maybe shamed a little bit. It was really functioning like a prison. And it seemed like the people who run this home are really taking advantage of the stigma and the shame that these young women feel. And they're often capitalizing on the fact that these women are very young and they're often very sheltered. And so these women feel like they're in trouble and they may not even know that they're allowed to leave. I couldn't believe how trapped these young women were.
Yeah, I mean, I was told by multiple subjects who we feature in the podcast who are at the maternity home at different during different years that doors and windows were locked around the clock, that they couldn't exit the building without a chaperone. There was a small courtyard that was completely fenced in with, I think it was a brick wall, was the fencing around it. And they even needed a chaperone to just go out there and sit. Abby Johnson, my main subject, she told me that a house parent told her that if she tried to open a door or window without permission, an alarm would go off. The girls inside the facility were not allowed to have jobs, so they were not allowed to try, to work to get some money to, hopefully have some resources when they gave birth. And any cash that they did have, according to the official Liberty God Parent Home Handbook, which I was able to obtain verified copies of, any cash they had, the facility held on to it, and they had to get permission from the executive director to take more than $10 out of their, money account. Their phone calls were monitored. You had, a chaperone standing next to them while they were making calls. And so, yeah, for a lot of the women I spoke to, they said it really did feel like a prison, and that their movements were restricted. I mean, a former staffer who I spoke to, Brittany Reynolds, we feature her in the show. I wish we actually would have had more space to include more of what she shared with me. But she even said, in terms of, the girls were expected to do chores around the maternity home, vacuuming, dusting, things like that. And if, everybody was in the living room vacuuming or dusting, and somebody had to go to the bathroom, they had to ask for permission to leave the room. Like even their movements within the home were being controlled. And so, yeah, it's this incredibly controlling environment. Most of the residents did come from either evangelical or Christian fundamentalist families where they were, shamed with purity culture growing up, told by church leaders, told by their community that sex outside of marriage is wrong, that they'll go to hell if they do it. And of course, they did have sex and they wound up pregnant on top of that. So a lot of them described feeling like they had a scarlet letter already on them. And the cultural beliefs of the home were reinforcing that scarlet letter and used it as an attempt to get women to separate from their children, that, if they wanted to redeem themselves for that sin of premarital sex, for that sin of getting pregnant out of wedlock, the path to redemption was through adoption. And so, yeah, it was, everywhere they looked, this kind of shame and stigma was being used as a tool to get them to separate from their children permanently.
Yeah, it's just shocking how aggressively these girls are framed as bad and treated like they have done something criminal and something very serious criminal. So I'm wondering if you can tell listeners a little bit about Abby and some of the other women you follow in the podcast and what happens to them over time. I don't want to spoil the story, but if you could give highlights.
Yeah, absolutely. So Abby Johnson is the primary subject in the podcast because, she was my original tip, as well as she was there most recently. She had entered into the Liberty Godparent Home in January of 2008. She stays there until she gives birth in July of 2008. And yeah, Abby came from an evangelical family in North Carolina. She had done a purity pledge to her father where she promised, to wear a ring that symbolized the fact that she would remain a virgin until she got married. Abby was homeschooled. She was very sheltered. And she meets a boy named Nathan through her homeschool community. And they start hanging out. And for a while, everything is really innocent. They're hanging out in groups. Nathan really likes her. She really likes him. They have a first kiss. And then she says, "Can we not kiss for a while? I just want to hold hands." And he's cool with that. And they have this kind of really sweet and tender teenage relationship. They sneak around, they watch The Notebook on a portable DVD player in the back seat of his car. They're hanging out, going to Taco Bell youth group meetings. And eventually, Abby's feelings for Nathan grow stronger. And they start to kiss. And eventually they start having sex. And Abby explains that, she was carrying a lot of shame around having sex, even though, it's something she wanted to do because of her religious upbringing. She was feeling that shame. And so she was constantly telling herself, "Well, we're not going to do it again. So I don't want to buy condoms because if we have the condoms, we'll do it again." And so they're not using birth control. When her parents find out about the pregnancy, they decide to send her away to the Liberty Godparent Home. Abby's two older sisters are students at Liberty University. Her mother, Debbie, also attended Liberty. And they learn about the Godparent Home, and they learn that if Abby completes the program, she can get a full ride scholarship to Liberty University. Now, back in 2008, that scholarship was worth $100,000. Of course, in the United States, it's illegal to exchange cash for a baby, but it seems that scholarships are a different story. And yeah, Abby finds herself there at the godparent home for months, and she tries and tries and tries to resist the shame, resist the pressure. She seeks out help from her counselor there that is employed by the godparent home, who basically brushes off her requests for help. And then, in one final attempt after she gives birth, she also goes to the adoption caseworker and says, "I don't want to do this." And the caseworker says to her, basically, "Wouldn't it be selfish of you to keep your son? This couple is really deserving," in so many words. I'm paraphrasing here. But, Abby at 17, She tries everything, and basically she describes being just beat down, and she eventually goes through with placing her son for adoption. The other women that we feature in the series include Toni Popham. Toni was 12 years old when she became pregnant. She and a neighborhood boy who was 13, they started exploring, and Toni became pregnant. A lot of the grown-ups in Toni's life wanted her to get an abortion. That is not something that she wanted. And she went to her mother, who was a Christian fundamentalist and very pro-life. And her mom said, "I'll help you." And her mother, speaks with her pastor, and the pastor suggests sending Toni to the godparent home, which she does go there, and she describes sort of endless pressure. She described the facility as pure torture, actually. She used that word, torture. Endless pressure to get her to place her daughter for adoption. Toni essentially is standing her ground. I mean, I give her a lot of credit as, a 12-year-old, or she was 13 by the time she got there. I mean, to be able to stand up and say, this is my choice. And I think, some feedback I've gotten from listeners was, well, maybe, somebody like Toni should have gotten abortion. She was so young. And probably if this would have happened to me at my age, my parents would have wanted me to end the pregnancy too, and I probably would have. But at the end of the day, I think one of the things I was trying to show is that we need to allow people to make their own reproductive choices. We can't insist people do anything when it comes to whether or not they will have children. Toni said, "I want to keep this child." Her mother, her, excuse me, her grandmother was actually adopted at birth, and her grandmother supported Toni's decision and said, "I was adopted, and I don't think you should place this baby for adoption." So Toni, gets her grandmother's support. Eventually, her mother comes around, and yet, she shares this with the godparent home, saying, "I have support now." And yet, when she goes to give birth in the delivery room, one of the staffers from the godparent home begins to pray over her body while she's trying to push and praying that she makes the right decision and places her daughter for adoption. So the coercion was lasting literally through birth. And Toni was roommates with a woman that is also featured in the podcast, Zoe Shaw. Zoe has a, similar, more similar story to Abby, I think. She was a little bit older. She was 15 when she found out she was pregnant through, her boyfriend that she liked at the time. She wanted to marry him, and she wanted to keep her daughter. She would go to the counselors at the godparent home and express that that was her desire and try to find help. And they, again, just brushed her off. And then Zoe becomes resigned to the fact that this is her fate, that nobody's coming to her rescue, and she does wind up placing her daughter for adoption. The other two people who we feature less so, they're smaller kind of roles in the podcast, but I think still equally as important, are Sarah P. Sarah was 18 when she became pregnant. She got pregnant as a result of sexual assault. She had gone to visit a cousin out of state, went to a party, drank too much. She had, came from a very sheltered home. That was one of the first times she was drinking, and she said the last thing she remembered was somebody climbing on top of her. But Sarah grew up in this, devout evangelical community. She was taught that abortion was murder, and she told me, she's like, "I didn't want to be a murderer in the eyes of God, so the only choice I had was to have this baby and place it for adoption," which is exactly what she does. And Sarah also gets the scholarship to Liberty University. She then goes on to work there as a house mother and is working with girls. Sarah had been all in on adoption when she entered the godparent home, so she never saw the other side. And when she sits down with girls who say, "Hey, I want to, keep my baby," she wants to help them make a parenting plan. But as Sarah goes through the questions that the godparent home provides her, she starts to realize that the whole plan seems designed to make you realize you can't do it alone, that there are questions there that these girls have, issues answering, and that then, the suggestion would be, well, if you can't figure this out, then maybe you should do an adoption. And so that's Sarah P's role. And then finally, in our final episode, we have a little bit of a story from a woman named Anna Smith. Anna became pregnant at 18. She had been experiencing homelessness at the time. She had aged out of foster care, and her foster parents said, "You can't continue to live with us." She was living out of her car. She starts dating a guy. She's staying at his house. They have sex. She gets pregnant. But then he wants nothing to do with her after he learns about the pregnancy. Sarah's back on the street, and she decides to go to the godparent home. She thought that they were going to help her figure out what her options were, but by the end of it, she felt like she also had no choice but to place her daughter for adoption. And so those are the main. And then I should also say there's Nathan Johnson, who is the boy Abby was dating. And Abby and Nathan, after Abby leaves the maternity home, they actually wind up getting married, and they went on to have two other children. They're no longer together today. They recently separated. I mean, they were together for about 15 years after that. And even Nathan, though he wasn't a resident of the godparent home, he also experienced abortion. Basically, the folks at the godparent home were trying to convince him to sign away his parental rights, saying that he might be able to get a scholarship to the school too if he did that. And then he was also experiencing pressure from Abby's parents, who threatened to charge him with statutory rape should he try to keep their child. Even though Abby says that she was 16 when they had sex, and Nathan at that time was 18, they're 2 years apart. And so, under North Carolina law, it that wouldn't have qualified for a statutory rape. Unfortunately for Nathan, his family did not seek legal counsel. They just talked to their religious community, and the religious community suggested that, it might push Abby's parents to make good on their threat if they obtain a lawyer. So unfortunately, he never got a lawyer. But he was also manipulated by the godparent home. And so that's sort of an overview of our main characters in Liberty Lost.
I mean, the level of just shameless coercion is really stunning and difficult to overstate. And there were so many times in the series where I was just like screaming, like, no, like, say no. But I think the thing that's so sad and that's so important to consider is that, well, first of all, I mean, the people running this home knew very well that many of these girls did not want to give up their babies, and knew very well that these girls weren't consenting to that, and pushed them into it anyway. But then the other bit is that, we can talk about the rights that mothers have and that people have to their children. But if you don't have access to any resources like a lawyer or money or knowledge about what rights you have no mechanism through which to enforce those rights, and therefore they don't really exist. And I think that helps explain why this home is so controlling, like why there are locks on the windows.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, the only in 2008, the only access to a computer that Abby had was in the godparent home's one room school. And there was an aide, a teacher right there that was employed by the facility. So she couldn't even, Google things if she wanted to. She was completely dependent on the information provided to her by the godparent home. And it's interesting. Sarah P, who was a resident and then went on to become a staffer there later on, she told me, from the point of view of many people that worked at the home, that they had this attitude that it's not right if you try to get social services, if you need a housing voucher, if you need to get on food stamps, if you need any kind of government assistance, that's not right. And so I think that's one of the reasons they were not, even attempting to connect these young girls and women to social services that would allow them to keep and parent their children. They just didn't believe that that was right, and they didn't want to offer them any help to do that. I think it's also ideological in that, the people that worked at the home believed in things like purity pledges, believed that premarital sex was wrong, and that it was a sin, and that these women needed to atone for that sin. I mean, we didn't actually play this part in the podcast, but Abby told me at one point they had her counselor's daughter came in to the godparent home one day, and she was singing a song, like it was like a little presentation. And she sung this song called Heal the Wound But Leave the Scar. And Abby interpreted that as, she has wounded her body, she has sinned, she has violated her body by having sex. And she needs to be left with a scar. And that scar is adoption. That scar is her not being allowed to keep her son. And so I think the ideological attitudes within the maternity home, helped shape a role in whether or not they were interested in trying to connect these girls and young women with resources.
Yeah, the attitudes that you point to, the idea of these girls as just like vessels for someone else's child. I think it's easy to dismiss this as like a weird religious ideology or an outlier, but to me, I see so many parallels between how these girls and women are treated and how we think of women, how we think of mothers, how we think of birthing people more broadly. What connections do you see?
Yeah, I see. I think single motherhood is still very stigmatized throughout the United States, whether or not you're in a religious community. It's become more socially acceptable. I had a single mom. My parents divorced when I was young. I love single mothers. But I think that in many communities across the United States, there is still, women who have children who are not married carry that scarlet letter still. And I think that throughout, over the course of my reporting, I realized that the same language of redemption is used throughout the adoption industry, as well as in faith-based maternity homes. I actually, in the podcast, we played a clip from one of the VPs at Heartbeat International, and she says, adoption is the greatest redemptive choice ever. And I don't understand why somebody who engaged in consensual sex and became pregnant would need to find redemption. And that's, again, related to an ideological attitude. That's a religious belief. And I think that, as I've dug into research on adoption more broadly, up to 80% of infant adoptions in the United States are done through religiously affiliated institutions. I don't think a lot of people realize that. And so, you have pregnant women maybe considering this, and they connect with these adoption agencies, and they get told kind of the same language. I spoke with one woman in the series, Katie Burns, and she's very interesting because she actually used to sit on the board of a crisis pregnancy center, and she wound up leaving the pro-life movement and leaving her work at the crisis pregnancy center because Katie had gotten pregnant at 19 and felt pressured to place her daughter for adoption. And she said, I wanted to help people. And when she was on the board of this crisis pregnancy center, they really just wanted to push adoption because of this belief that, single scandalous women having babies and needing government support, that's bad. Let's, make sure these babies go to the quote unquote right kinds of homes. And so I do see this, cultural belief, unfortunately, play out throughout the industry.
Well, and in terms of this redemption narrative, it's redemption through an act of like really immense pain and trauma. And that's just completely like swept under the rug. And I really appreciate how your podcast centers the suffering of these women, and not just these women, but their parents sometimes and their partners, and it's a terrible trauma.
Yeah, I mean, According to the sociologist Gretchen Cision, who I did interview for the podcast, birth mothers, whether or not they went through a maternity home, often report deep feelings of grief and pain for their entire lives. And a lot of the birth mothers I've spoken to, they have also shared with me that even someone like, let's say, Sarah P., who actively wanted to choose adoption, she told me, it's still hard on her, even though that was the choice she wanted and the choice she made, because, she gestated this baby for 9 months. She felt him kick, she felt him move, she gave birth to him. He is a part of her, and she does have a very good relationship with his parents, the people who adopted him, and she's still in contact with him, but it's still painful because it's her son that she placed for adoption. And so I don't think, I think oftentimes in the movies and on TV, we see these brief portraits of birth mothers who place their children with smiling couples, and then they're just guided off screen, and we never hear from them again. And from what my reporting and research has found, is birth mothers usually experience intense and ongoing grief and trauma related to adoption. And so, yeah, I mean, those things are not talked about or promoted by adoption agencies, because if they had that kind of informed counseling related to this, I'm not sure how many people would want to actually make that choice.
Yeah, so I wonder if in light of all of that, I think some people might dismiss the maternity homes as like weird outliers of like, well, that happens to some women who are in extremist sects, but mainstream adoption is probably fine. I wonder how you feel about that idea and if this podcast has shifted your perspective on adoption more broadly.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this has radically reshaped my views on adoption. Research shows, I actually in November did a piece with NPR. I traveled to a conference of birth mothers in Atlanta, and I talked to dozens of birth mothers there. And n most of them, 90% of them, didn't go through maternity homes. I spoke with one woman who is just kind of starting out on this journey right now, and she is 31, and she got pregnant by her boyfriend, and when she found out, they broke up. She was kind of struggling in all of the classic millennial ways. She lived in Seattle. The rent was really high. She didn't know how she was going to make it work. She was having to move out of the house that she was living with her boyfriend and find a roommate. And she's like, I'm pregnant. She didn't want to get an abortion. She thought that maybe I can figure this out by the end of 9 months. And that didn't happen. And she connected with an adoption agency. And in the hospital, after her son was born, she wanted to change her mind, but she didn't have enough money for a car seat. And she said, because she didn't have enough money for a car seat, she didn't know how she would be able to take him home. And so she felt that she had no choice but to just continue with the adoption. And that's just, I mean, devastating, obviously. And yeah, I think that the adoption industry, they need vulnerable pregnant women and pregnant people to say, I want to separate from my child. And if you look at available research, from peer-reviewed studies, the number one reason why women pursue adoption is because they lack financial resources and support. And so, if you were to offer people, access to safe and stable housing, access to, SNAP benefits, access to healthcare, if you were to create the conditions that would allow somebody to raise a child, 99% of people don't want to continue with that adoption. And so really the adoption industry, I mean, it functions by making sure vulnerable pregnant women separate from their children.
Yeah, it's all so scary and sad. So I'm curious. I think the temptation when you listen to something like this is to think, okay, well, now that this has come to light, everything's going to change and people are going to be shamed into better behavior at these sorts of places. Has anything changed since the airing of the podcast? What's going on with these sorts of maternity homes now?
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately, the Liberty Godparent Home, it's still open, it's still operating, as well as its, adoption agency, Family Life Services. I see some momentum from adoptees, so adult people who were adopted, to push that are leading the conversation now to push to provide people with more resources. And I see really incredible organizations. There's one called Reproductive Justice in Adoption that are also pushing to, help. They helped, I think, Planned Parenthood rewrite their section on their website regarding adoption. And I'm hopeful that birth mothers are going to continue to speak up. For a long time, women didn't have the ability or the platform to be able to speak about these issues. Social media didn't exist. Like when we think about, the baby scoop era, back in the, 50s and 60s. But now this new generation is taking to TikTok to share these stories, both birth parents as well as adopted people. And so I think that there is starting to be some kind of cultural shift around the ways we think about adoption. But I think that there's a long way to still go. If you look at a group like, let's say, the Congressional Coalition on Adoption Institute, which is a bipartisan group made up of lawmakers who push for adoption-friendly legislation, most of those lawmakers are, adoptive parents themselves. And so you think about the power differentials. Like, if you're a vulnerable pregnant woman and you place your child for adoption, you might be doing that out of poverty. You don't have the same kind of power as a senator. And so I think we all need to be thinking critically. And I think we as a society need to, push for family preservation policies. And family preservation policies are the same kinds of policies that could help anyone. I'm talking about access to affordable housing, talking about access to healthy food, to clean drinking water, to health insurance, to childcare. All of those things can mean the difference between somebody pursuing adoption and not, and all of those things could, help all of us. And so I think continuing to push for policies that support women and families and vulnerable people is the way that we're going to see real change. And that's a long road, obviously.
Yeah, well, and I think so. We'll see if I can articulate this well or not. The thing that I kept thinking about while I was listening to your podcast is that we pretend that we have an egalitarian world and that, women and men are equal and all of this. And one of the ways that we're able to do this is that we create these social structures that control women while the law still says they're equal. So, like, we can see this in things like household labor inequality and how this creates so much work for women to do that just like suppresses their dreams and makes it very difficult for them to lobby for political change because the workload is just too unbearable. And we also see this with the sort of adoption, pregnancy, single mother narrative where we just shame and stigmatize and treat these women as bad. And I think that's really important to highlight. And I'm so glad that you're doing that and showing that like things can seem like they're okay and things can seem like they're equal. But underneath all of this, look at all of these ways that we're controlling women and shutting them off from their dreams and really like harming and traumatizing them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at the current administration, they, have cut Medicaid, which pays for 40% of births in the United States. They have cut, childhood programs. They have cut food assistance. They have cut housing programs. And I think they very clearly have articulated an agenda that prioritizes white male power over everyone else and the subjugation of women. And that can be through, cutting, family preservation programs, that can be through restricting abortion access, that can be prosecuting women for having miscarriages. I think the new Heritage Foundation agenda, the vision for the family, I think they're calling it, says that women need to have less education because when they do, they have children more often and earlier. And so I think that there is a cohort in the United States that very actively wants to see us return, to the 1950s. And they are pushing that agenda right now. And I think we need to be aware of it. We need to call it for what it is and continue to fight and push for policies that, don't just benefit women or birthing people, but benefit families and really benefit all of us as, people who live in a society.
I really appreciate you talking about that and also just talking more broadly about the fact that like women aren't a separate kind of human. Like policies that benefit women benefit us all. So yeah. Okay, so I would like to hear briefly about your prior two podcasts, Cover Up and Biohacked, in case people want to listen to those. And also if you have any other projects in the works that people might want to hear about.
Yeah, so Cover Up the Pill Plot is a show I put out with Sony's Global Podcast Division in June of 2023. So basically, I went from that to working straight with Abby on Liberty Lost. But Cover Up is, it's just, I love this story, honestly. It's hopeful, it's incredible. It's basically focuses on a group of radical feminists from the Bay Area who were active in the early 90s, and they are like, kind of punk riot girls, and they team up with this fancy pants New York City activist who is actually one of the founders of Gnarled Pro-Choice America. And they want to bring the abortion pill to America. The abortion pill was released in Europe in the 1980s and in the early 90s. They want it here because they realize very smartly, and I think we're seeing this now, that if you could end a pregnancy with a pill, any doctor theoretically could prescribe it, and it would make abortion much harder to regulate. And so these activists devise a plan where they're going to find a pregnant woman, fly her to London, where the pill is legal, the abortion pill at that time, obtain the pill, fly back to the United States, and intentionally tip off customs that they're entering the country with this illegal medication. They want to do that to trigger an arrest and to basically challenge this ban through the US court system. And that's exactly what they do. And that podcast kind of documents that journey with the original participants. And then they take it all the way up to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, they do lose in the court, and it takes several more years for the abortion pill to become legalized. But while that is all happening, there's rapid anti-abortion terrorism happening at clinics, clinic bombings, people are being shot, there are acid attacks. And that also connects to why these activists so desperately wanted the pill to be legalized, because if you could remove abortion from solely abortion clinics, it would provide much broader protection for everyone. And so, as part of my reporting, I also interviewed a convicted domestic terrorist who engaged in some of these activities, and kind of document the struggle there, to pass the FACE Act, which protects, clinics from anti-abortion violence, and kind of document the journey from the early 90s until, 2000, the year 2000, when the abortion pill finally gets legalization, September 2000, following month. George W. Bush and Al Gore have a presidential debate, and the election happens, and we all know the rest is history. So it really came in just under the wire. And so that's what Cover Up the Pill Plot is about. It's seven episodes, and it's an inspiring story, honestly, of activism. Biohacked Family Secrets is, yeah, about our unregulated fertility industry. I basically came to that story after a friend of mine from college, I hadn't seen her in about 10 years, And I was catching up with her, what's new, what's going on? And she said, well, I just did a DNA test and found out my dad is not my biological father. And I was conceived with a sperm donor and I probably have 150 siblings. And I was like, wow, can I record you? Because I'm a nosy journalist. And so I started kind of working with her just on her personal story. But as I kind of started asking questions, I'm like, wait, how is this possible? How is that possible? I realized that there are not a lot of, safety regulations basically in place in the fertility industry. Fertility medicine is incredible. I've had my eggs frozen. I know people who have conceived children via IVF. But when it comes to questions of donations, there are a lot of what I see as unethical practices in the industry related to sperm donation, but also with egg donation as well. And so it really is it's an anthology, and each episode covers kind of a different topic related to the industry, but really dives deeply into questions of shame as well as identity, genetics, and community. So that's what Biohacked is about.
It sounds awesome, and I'm sure people will love it. What are you working on now?
Yeah, so I'm in the process of just starting to develop some new stories. Basically we wrapped Liberty Lost in July over the summer of 25, and unfortunately, Wondery, the company that produced the show, I was on staff at that time, and they announced that they were laying off the entire editorial staff.
Oh,
So,
no.
yeah, despite the massive success of the show, they just, Amazon decided they did not want to have in-house journalists anymore. So, I took some time off, especially after the sprint that I had had between going straight from Cover Up to Liberty Lost, and it was kind of 3 years of working nonstop. And so I took some time off at the end of this year, and now, it's February. I'm just kind of restarting, looking at some new stories. One story that I'm beginning to research for is what I would have done as a season two of Liberty Lost, had, the company continued. And it's looking at a girls' residential facility that's currently still operational, a Christian residential facility for girls and young women who have behavioral issues, so eating disorders, anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicidal ideation. Unfortunately, this facility has no doctors on staff, and the program will basically help you pray away your eating disorder or your depression. And shocker, it doesn't work. And a lot of the women that I've now connected with, I've connected with about 10 women who have gone to these facilities. They have been in California, they've been in Missouri, Tennessee, and they're opening a new location in Nashville. And I basically am starting to investigate that facility. I feel like this has echoes for our bigger society about, the ways women's health is not taken seriously, and also these ideas that women's, problems are not important. They should, be seen and not heard, kind of thing. And so that's I'm just kind of getting started digging in from a reporting perspective, as well as starting to look separately on a different story about the concept of parental alienation in the family court system. And this was a tactic that was popularized by Woody Allen after he was accused of molesting his children. He hired a psychiatrist to say that, Mia Farrow, his wife, had just alienated him, and that's why the children were saying that. And unfortunately, this parental alienation theory has gained popularity in the years since in the family court system, and it is used by people. When people are getting a divorce, an abusive partner will say, "No, I'm being alienated, and I need access to the children and to my ex-spouse." And I've found that they are, some really scary things happening there as it relates to power dynamics in the court system. And so that's a story that I'm just also in the early stages of pursuing. So yeah.
I really hope you do more about parental alienation because I don't personally write a lot about parental alienation, but it connects a lot to my work because Parental alienation, family courts, child custody is like the main thing keeping women in abusive relationships. This idea of children as property who have to be split 50-50. I just spoke with a woman last week who left her abuser and, she thought that she was getting free and she got an initial restraining order and it seemed like everything was going well. And ultimately the courts gave him 50-50 custody and he murdered their child about 3 months ago.
Oh my God.
And this is happening like everywhere. And we hear about the murders, but what we don't hear about are like the molestations, the emotional abuse, the just years and years and years of trauma inflicted on these children, because we just think that, abusive men should have access and that if you accuse a man of abuse, you must just be an alienator.
Exactly. Yeah. So I've connected with an activist down in Georgia, and she's actually got a bill introduced in the state house there that would hopefully curtail some of this parental alienation to be used in court, as well as there are now reunification camps where basically courts ordering children to reunify with a parent. And so that happened to her, and she's got this legislation, and I know that now in 8 states they've banned these reunification camps. But I feel like this is connected to bigger issues that we see, and I think the Trump administration again is pushing for no-fault divorce. I think this ties in there as well. And so yeah, I'm kind of in the early stages of interviewing people and starting to build out. What a story would be. And so, for your listeners, if anybody wants to keep up with my work, you can check out my website, which is tjraphael.com, or I'm on Instagram at tjrafs. I have a Blue Sky, but I don't really use it. I feel like I should probably start more.
Same,
But
same.
I'm there and I'm on TikTok too. And so, people can follow me. A lot of times my reporting will take the shortest runway I usually do is a year, so it could be a while for me to actually get something out, but that's because I really take the time to do the deep research and the reporting around it. So you can kind of keep up with me online, and when something drops, I am that person that will blast it everywhere constantly. So yeah.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah.
So don't after we're done recording, I have a few things to talk with you about this. But listeners, I will put all of TJ's information in the show notes. And definitely if you have stories relevant to this, like please reach out to her because this is such a huge, important topic to cover, all of these topics really. TJ, you're doing such amazing work and you are bringing to light the terrible things that happen in darkness. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was so great. And yeah, if any listener has a tip about anything, my inbox is always open and I'm always interested. So yeah.
Awesome. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And listeners, I will be back with you next week.